within the trails we ride.
You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author who helps empower horse people from all over the world with the skills, knowledge, and mindsets needed to create trusting partnerships with their horses. Warwick offers a free 7-day trial to his comprehensive online video library that includes hundreds of full-length training videos and several home study courses at videos.warwickschiller.com. Just because you see
what is sure. G'day everyone, welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host Warwick Schiller, and my very, very special guest this week is a lady named Kelly Wendorf. And after recording the podcast with Kelly, I just don't have enough good things to say about her. What an amazing human being, an amazing outlook on life. Let me read you some of Kelly's bio here. It says, Kelly Wendorf is an executive and personal coach, published author, spiritual mentor, disruptor, and socially responsible entrepreneur. Her early experiences were vitally and deeply shaped by the natural and ancient world around her, where she learned a way of listening to forces within people, nature, and moments. This unconventional education grants her the gift of perception that liberates untapped potential and hidden gifts within individuals and organizations, helping them to solve problems differently through a wisdom-informed and wholeness approach. Throughout her life, she's lived and worked around the world, studying with many spiritual and indigenous leaders in India, Africa, Indonesia, and Australia. Such immersion in multicultural perspectives has honed a passion for creating a new narrative in the human condition, empowering high-performing individuals, organizations, and their leaders to wield meaningful change in their families, communities, and in the world through servant leadership and innovative business development. She's worked inside a spectrum of clientele from Amazon to Microsoft to some of the most underserved communities. She's been called a corporate shaman and a CEO whisperer. Kelly founded, edited, and published Kindred magazine in Australia, an evidence-based publication that explores the social, cultural, and biological underpinnings of a compassionate society. Here she spent 15 years immersed in the field of neuroscience and neurophysiology and its relationship to social justice and transformative cultural change. Kelly also authored and edited Stories of Belonging, an anthology from authors around the world, including the often excluded Indigenous voices. Her book, Flying Lead Change, was released in December 2020. Kelly's book, Flying Lead Change, I do talk about it on this podcast, but she sent it to me before the podcast, and I think it's one of those books that, you know, if I did another episode called Books That Have Influenced Me, this one would be at the top of the list. An amazing book, amazing human, and this was an amazing conversation, and I hope you guys enjoyed as much as I did. Kelly Wendorf, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
So good to be here, Warwick. Thank you.
Hey, it's so good to have you here. I'm as excited about this conversation as I have been about any conversation, mostly because I kind of have a rough idea of some of the stories that I might drag out of you, and I'm excited to hear them from you. So you're one of those people that I became aware of. Someone emailed me and said, hey, you really should check out this lady. And I checked out your website and then contacted you. Mm-hmm. And you sent me a copy of your book, Flying Lead Change, which I'm slowly digesting. And it could be, I'm not all the way through it yet, but it could be the top of the list as far as cool books I've ever read.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, because I know the books you've read.
Yeah, you're kind of, we talked before and you said you're a bit of an avid listener to the podcast, so you kind of know what's mm-hmm. going on. And, you know, when I have guests on the podcast, sometimes they've never heard of me and they have no idea what the podcast's about and they've never listened to any, but you have listened to quite a few guests, so you kind of know what you're yes. in for.
I know.
And we're going to get into some of the stuff in your book, but why don't you tell us what you currently do in the world and to make the world a better place? And then I want to unravel, like most of my guests, I want to unravel, how did you get to that point?
Yeah, thank you so much. So, you know, the term that I use in the world is coach, spiritual mentor, but really those are just words. I really love to accompany people into places that unlock their authenticity, their genuine way of being in the world, their undomesticated expression and their voice. So whether it's a private individual or corporate groups, I love working in the corporate sector because those organizations wield so much influence in the world. And if I can impact two or three key people in those big organizations, then the trickle-down effect is, you know, amazing, or the possibility for that. So I love to be an advocate for people's most free, true spirit in the world, however that expresses itself. And I do that usually through partnering with nature in some way, horses sometimes, nature as often as possible. And then sometimes it's like this on a phone call or on a Zoom call. So that's sort of it in a nutshell.
You know, you mentioned the corporate world, and there's been a number of guests on the podcast who have been high flyers in the corporate world, and then they have a bit of a U-turn, and now they possibly do something like what you do. And you said you like working with the corporate world. Do you find that, say, in the corporate world, they are, how do I put this? Like a bunch of virgins about looking at the world this way. It's kind of like, say, me with the horses. When I do a clinic, most people who come to a clinic know the way I view the world. And the spectators and the people in the clinic know the way I view the world and I view the horses. And it's still, you know, still can be quite transformational. But if I do say a horse expo where the people don't look at the horses and haven't ever looked at the horses in the world the way I currently do, you find that, whoa, it's so much more impactful. Do you find that in the corporate world? Because I'm thinking that if they're in the corporate world, they've kind of got a certain mentality that brought them there. You know, I read a book one time called What Got You Here Won't Get You There.
I know that book, yes.
And I'm wondering if that's what you find in the corporate world, like the corporate mindset got them this far, but there's a missing piece that's going to get them to the next thing.
Yes. So that's what's so fascinating about working in the corporate sector. I mean, when I first became a professional, And I wasn't training horses, which was something I did back in my 20s. I was such a tree hugger, you know, as a teenager and in my early 20s. And so I had this kind of very, very rigid bias about the corporate sector and people in the corporate sector. And then I made a decision that, you know, I was going to work in that area because of the change that could be leveraged. But then I was so surprised by what I found once I walked into that arena. And it's a mixed bag. There are folks who are deeply wise individuals who do this because they too are there because they want to make a difference. So they're kind of, you know, they're a little bit incognito doing some deep good work with the facade of, you know, the corporate person. And so that's a little bit like a treasure hunt to find those folks because we speak the same language. And I often work hard to find them so that when I'm in a corporate setting, I've got folks already on board where we're talking the same language. And then you find people like you talk about with the Horse Expo who somehow, you know, never had that opportunity to awaken to something, and all you have to do is say one word or make one move or show something slightly different, and they go, oh my gosh. And that's, you know, that's so rewarding as well. So it's mixed and very surprising. And the more I've been inside the corporate sector, the more, this is going to sound really interesting, but the more hope I have for humanity. Because I see the humanity at work inside the corporate sector. And as long as I see that humanity, then I feel like there's hope for us.
Yeah, I find that, you know, at the horse expos with people who haven't been exposed to maybe this way of looking at things, there's some part of them that was wanting it to show up. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's, you know, it's almost like you know, a part of their humanity has been dampened a little bit, but they know, they kind of have this inkling that it's in there and they, you know, wish it could be. Yeah. Okay. So let's unravel how you ended up doing what you're doing. So you tell us about your childhood. So your father was an archaeologist, and reading your book, it's like, sounds like your dad was like Indiana Jones, you know?
He kind of was. He loved those movies. You know, he was gregarious and a bit debonair, and, you know, all the graduate students really loved him. And so he's quite a notable archaeologist, and was part of finding, he was responsible for finding what's known as the Midland Man, which was one of the missing links of prehistoric man. And spent most of his time on digs in Africa, and also northern New Mexico. He's responsible for policy, federal policy, that requests that archaeologists can go in on, say, a pipeline or any kind of building structure that's about to happen. If they're going to be digging in the earth now, you have to have archaeologists come in and make sure that there aren't, you know, things there that are worth restoring or maintaining. And so he was, you know, quite a figure. And because of that, my childhood was unusual. We didn't really go on family holidays. We went on digs. This is what we did. So I spent a large part of my childhood alone, kind of just messing around in nature. And, you know, that was the way it was. The parenting was very much benign neglect back in those days, right? We were just free to go and do what we wanted to do, just be home by dark.
Yeah.
And and so I, you know, I was running around on archaeological digs and in forests and hanging out inside indigenous communities. And I think this gave me an uncommon education. It's a different perspective when you're looking back 6,000 years, 60,000 years, you know, way beyond that, and you're looking at the footprint of humankind, and that, you know, whether or not I was consciously a part of these conversations, I was in that soup of these kinds of conversations. Who were these people? What were they doing in the world? What was important to them? Was there violence? This was something that was always fascinating to me. Were we always so destructive to the natural world, or was there indeed some time back where we were more harmonious? The answers, of course, are not black and white at all. But these were there was just this deep kind of ubiquitous inquiry that was around me at all times. In addition, a lot of the people I hung out with and played with were indigenous folks who had a completely different worldview. So I felt like a sort of weird kid, because I much preferred the company of my animals and my horses and the natural world to what I found at school. I found school to be confusing, and all the rules that we had to abide by, I didn't understand. And so I found myself a little bit with my feet in two different worlds. One was, you know, the world of, you know, a white girl who has to, you know, get married, find a job, have kids, join a sorority, you know, all these things. And then this other world that was deep and meaningful and made sense and gave me a sense of belonging. And so that was there was a sort of tension there that I think drove me for most of my life, my adult life and my young adult life, that tension of these two worlds. And if this contemporary world with all of its privilege was indeed so privileged, why is everyone so unhappy? Why is there so much stress? Why is there so much chronic pain and chronic disease and divorce and bullying and, you know, all these things that we're looking at right now? And if this other world is indeed so primitive as we were told, well, then why is it so peaceful and happy and joyous? So I spent the better part of my young adulthood looking for answers about that for myself, first and foremost.
You said in there that, you know, you're more at home hanging out with animals and nature, and then not so much at school. But then in there you mentioned hanging with Indigenous people. Are you including that in the nature?
Yes. Well, they're one and the same to me.
Yeah.
And so are we, right? We are nature too.
But what I'm saying is that you didn't feel strange hanging out with those people.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
No, I felt accepted and loved, and very, very deeply loved, and that I belonged, you know. Whereas in my conventional life, the so-called contemporary life, belonging was conditional upon, are you good enough? Are you fast enough? Are you a good enough athlete? Are you a nice enough girl? You know, all that kind of stuff.
Right. In your introduction to your book, you talk about going to Ethiopia.
Mm.
On a dig that your dad was on, and you had someone who was looking after you there named Kabada. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Kabada, yes.
Yeah. Can you tell us about him?
And what I invite folks to do as they hear this story is to reflect also where their story is sort of similar. I gather that a lot of people listening to your podcast, Warwick, have had some awakening experience in their life. Something happened, you know, either before they remember or when they were young, or they had a moment with a person or with music or with a horse, and it awakened something. And so I don't feel like my story is particularly unique in the sense that this awakening is what's so magical that so many of us share, and that your podcast helps us all come together around that. But my awakening happened with Kabada, who Kabada was an Oromo warrior. The Oromo people are the indigenous people of Ethiopia, and I think many regions of North Africa. And my father had hired him. I was only 7 at the time. My brother was 3. And we, he didn't really want to have to deal with 2 children out in the Ethiopian bush. So he hired Kabada to be our kind of guard. It was the 1970s. 2, you know, white children with blonde hair were a total kidnapping target at the time because there was a lot of political unrest in Ethiopia. And Kabada was to keep us safe from kidnappers and keep us safe from baboons. Those were the two things. And I'll never forget the moment that he showed up. He was walking towards us from a distance, and he had this wonderful kind of white blanket thrown over his shoulder, like an emperor might, right? And then the rest of him was bare, his long, long legs. He had an earring that dangled down. He had a little metal lunchbox, and he came walking towards me, his feet barefooted. I even remember the dust kind of rising up from his feet as he walked, and how his feet sort of landed so firmly on the ground. I mean, he made an enormous impression on me. And, well, his job was to guard us, but as far as I was concerned, his job was to be my friend. That was the deal. So we didn't speak the same language, but I, you know, through a lot of pantomime and all of this, was able to get him on board with, you know, of course, I was a horse-crazy girl, and he had to be my horse. He had to be my, you know, cowboy and I was the Indian. He had to be all these things. And so this was why, how we spent our time together. All day long, we were, you know, just having wonderful time together. And there came a time at some point that we had to leave many weeks later. And I didn't understand. I was too young to understand we were leaving. We would never come back to Ethiopia. I would never see Kabata again. It was sort of 4 a.m. We were all packing everything up. The Range Rovers and the Jeeps were getting packed up with all their gear. And Kabata, who was normally never sitting down, I never saw Kabata sit down. Even at night, he would stand with his spear, kind of propped up against his spear, kind of by my door at night to guard me. And this time he was sitting sort of slumped over in a little metal chair. And I jumped onto his lap and just kind of like was so happy to see him. And I could feel like our energies were mismatched. I was so happy and he was devastated. And I was like, what's going on? So I, you know, pulled myself away and looked at his face, and he had all these tears pouring down his face. And first of all, I'd never seen a man cry before. I'd never felt a man be vulnerable. And I had never felt, and I get emotional just thinking about it now, I had never felt so much unconditional love before. And this included my parents, right, who love me very much, but I had not felt that. That this was something else. This was his whole heart just there for me. And I kind of folded myself back into his arms and I just felt him cry and felt his chest. And it was all very, very somatic, right? Very experienced. And we sat there for, you know, I don't know, 5 minutes probably. And it was a felt experience of, I think the only way I can describe it is that this is what it really meant to be human. That, you know, if before we're born and after we die, we are merged with some kind of infinite power or infinite love, okay, fine. But can we experience that while we're alive on Earth? And this was that experience. It was total. I was, you know, too young to conceptualize it, but it was real. And it was like, this is why we're here on Earth, to love each other, to be connected, to recognize our connection already, to be free in that connection. I mean, what a beautiful thing. I mean, I'm sure this is what animals do when they just hang out together, just being together, that they're just in this bliss of total connection. And it changed me. I was too young to know what it was. I didn't understand what it was, but it created an inflection point in my life where I would never, ever be the same. So that was the moment where I realized there were two worlds at play. You know how they say, when a pearl is created, there's a grain of sand, and that friction that creates the pearl. That moment created so much friction in my life. And I'm not saying it was easy, because I became rebellious. I was bullied easily. I was too sensitive. I couldn't quite buy in to the status quo, you know, which made it hard for me growing up. So, but it was important, right?
Did you feel, after feeling that with Kabata, did you feel the absence of it in other interactions with people?
Yes, I did. I did. And it's wonderful to have this conversation because things are coming together even now as we speak. So the first person in my crosshairs was my father, because of course there was a man who had loved me like this in we didn't even speak the same language. We weren't same family members. And so suddenly I was confused why I didn't feel this with my father. Why did I not feel it from him? And why did I not feel it towards him? And, you know, as a young kid, I wasn't sophisticated enough to articulate this, but it created a lot of tension between us. And of course, what I did is turned it on myself. Obviously, there must be something wrong with me that I can't do what Kibata did with me, you know? So, and it kind of angled me towards being very social justice minded. I would walk out onto our street corner with placards about not polluting and taking care of the planet and don't cut down the trees and be kind to animals. And I was just shouting into such a void because the world was just moving ahead at its own pace. So yes, it made me more critical of others and isolated. I felt a little lonely. And you wouldn't have known this meeting me. You would have thought I was kind of a neat kid that, you know, just was getting along in the world. But it didn't feel that way from the inside. Right. Yeah.
So where did you grow up? Where were you living at the time?
So I was born and raised in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And then we moved to Texas so my father could be a professor at SMU. But 3 months of every year, we went back to Taos, New Mexico, so that he could work on digs in northern New Mexico. So I never really felt like a Texan. I always felt like a New Mexican. Mm. And New Mexico is an amazing place because the indigenous peoples here, they're farmers. They're not hunter-gatherers. They were never nomadic. And so their feet were really planted in the soil. And because of that, they weren't as easily moved off from their place as many other different groups were. And so even when you're here now, in fact, my ranch manager is a member of the Tusuke and Nambe Pueblos. Their culture is intact. Their language is intact. And that gives you a very special experience because you can feel it when you come here.
Wow. Yeah. I want to get back to that, but there's something you said about your father. So I don't, you know, this is my ignorance about archaeology. So Indiana Jones was a professor and an archaeologist. Your dad was a professor and an archaeologist. Are all archaeologists professors?
No.
Oh, okay. I didn't know. Like,
that's a great question, though, and I love it. Yes, and they're certainly not all Indiana Jones, I can tell you that. But you know, some are researchers, some elect to teach, some write books, some, lead things in museums. I think that the different ways that archaeology can express itself can be quite diverse. And he was sort of all three. He was a professor, he was a researcher, he had his chair was endowed, and he was always going on trips that have been funded by grants so that he could continue to do his research.
So where apart from Ethiopia did you travel as a kid to digs?
We were in Egypt. So those were the two places in Africa that I traveled. He used to be a scuba diver and do underwater archaeology with the Spanish galleons that had crashed outside the coastline of Texas, and then northern New Mexico. Those were his sort of four places where he spent his time. And you know, he was he was not an easy person. He was definitely on the narcissistic end of the spectrum, and didn't really know how to relate to people very well. But I've done a lot of work around my dad, and just am so grateful that I'm so grateful he was my father and the experiences that he brought to me that I wouldn't have had not been, you know, for him and all the things that he did. So,
yeah, the Kibata experience sounds you know, like a life changer. So when you were, you know, when you were in, say, in high school, what did you think you wanted to be when you grew up, if we ever grow up?
Yeah, if we ever grow up, you know, I still feel like I'm sort of 12 or something. There was a time where I started to fall asleep. I think the pressure of having to perform and to be, I succumbed to the pressure to conform. I'll just put it that way. And it started to happen around high school and college. I always had my horse or horses with me, thank goodness. They sort of tethered me to this, they kind of kept the lifeline alive. I'm forever grateful for that. But around high school, my mother remarried. We became part of a blended family. I don't know if you know much about blended families, but it can be very, very tricky when, you know, your membership in the family is conditional. And so you suddenly have, you know, stepbrothers and stepsisters and step-grandparents, and they either like you or they don't like you, and it can be very complicated. I think it's complicated for everybody who's involved. And I believe that kind of left me vulnerable to a bit losing my way. So I ended up in high school having an eating disorder. And eating disorders are, I think, vastly misunderstood. They're not about weight. They're not about food or eating. They're about, for me anyway, I see it more as a spiritual disease, that one loses one's connection to something, you know, eternally true or foundationally important. And you go into high alert of creating so much control around your life so that you feel safe. And for me, it was about, you know, every calorie, every effort I made to exercise became this kind of supercomputer obsession to have 100% dominion over my life in an external world that felt very out of control. So I lost my way there. Horses, I would have to say, brought me back, because you can't stay that unwell and manage a horse. It just doesn't work well together. Joined a sorority, just did all that stuff. Worked for a radio station in Dallas, Texas, doing marketing. My boss was one of the founders of MTV and was a coke addict. So it was really intense. I feel like the getting lost is also such an important part of the journey, because the person you have to become to re-find yourself, it calls forward qualities that you never thought were there. So I really see, you know, we say getting lost, but I really see the getting off the rails, falling off the wagon, getting lost, whatever, however one frames it. It's a very, very important part of the process. Have you found that? Have you ever gotten lost and seen what it got, what it gave you?
Yes. I mean, I feel like I'm on a big version of lost at the moment, actually. So, you know, I don't know who or what I am going to be on the other side of this. But I feel like I'm really actually quite lost. So, but the thing is, I have enough experience to know that it's part of the process, so I'm at ease with it. It's not like, oh God, it's not working. Right. I'm like, okay, this is, I feel like I'm a little lost right now, actually. Learning some things about me. So I think that's the big thing is being at ease with being lost. It's not, you're not lost. It's actually, you're on the right track. It's part of your, you know, it's part of your soul's purpose, if you want to put it that way, is to get to a certain place, and you can't get to that place without getting lost and going through all the things that happen when you get lost. Indeed. So yeah, and I, you know, I'm just kind of at ease with the unease at the moment.
Yes.
So,
yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think it's a very, very important message. And I'm so grateful that you confided in that, because folks don't want to confess that they're maybe lost or they've lost their way, or, you know, it's not what's sold in all the new age sort of transformational stuff that's out there, because it's not sexy and it's not pretty and it's often messy. You know, the countless mistakes that I've made and bad marriages and bad business partnership, you know, it's all just part of our humanity.
Yes. So, yeah. So you, I mean, but your point about the getting lost thing is, you know, one of the questions that you chose, we'll get to that probably a bit later in your story, but one of the questions you chose was what's been your biggest failure and how has it helped you? Because always biggest failures help us. You know, when you, totally. When you look back, you know, like, what year would it be? 2006, something happened to where at the time it was catastrophic. But at the, looking back now, like, well, we wouldn't be doing what we're doing now if that hadn't happened. So, and there's been a lot of those. And I think when you can look back and see a few of those, it allows you to go through whatever's happening at the moment with a bit more grace.
Yes. And, you know, gosh, it was probably about 8 years ago. I was talking to a friend of mine and I was lamenting that, you know, there's just been one scenario after another that was challenging or a mistake or failed something or whatever. And I said, you know, here I am, a coach, and I keep, you know, making these mistakes. And she said, look, when you were born, you weren't born to have a white picket fence. You were born to be of service to the world, right? Yes, 100%. I knew this was true. I always knew this was true. She said, well, then, you know, all of the life lessons and curriculum is going to be completely different for you because it's part of what you teach as well. I mean, I can't very well support somebody through bankruptcy if I hadn't experienced it myself. I can't very well work with someone whose kids have just come out of the closet as trans if I didn't have a kid who was gender fluid, you know. So it not only has served me to be more wise and compassionate, but 100,000% it supports me to be of better service in the world. She said, you know, if you were supposed to be an electrician, you would have gotten those kinds of lessons, but you're not. You're a coach, you're a teacher. So this is your curriculum. So I've started to really see the challenges in my life as curriculum, at PhD level curriculum.
Speaking of PhD level, so you went to college. What did you study at college?
Lost. So marketing, you know, someone turned, you're a high school senior. Someone turns to you and says, oh, it's graduation day. What are you going to be? I don't know. I mean, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a vet, of course. But then I just was like, well, I don't know, TV, marketing, I don't know. So I kind of went into college a little bit blind. But I did travel overseas. I spent a year in France. Lived with a French family, only spoke French. And that was really, really important to get out of the States, live as a, you know, a citizen somewhere else. That was super formative and really good. I wish every child could do that when they're in college.
Yeah, the whole, you know, that saying, going and coming back is not the same as never having left.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, when
there's so much we see.
Yeah, when you travel and then you come back, you see things completely differently than you did before you left, even though it's the same place.
Mm-hmm, completely. And, you know, every country has its wonderful side. Every country has its shadow side. There is no most amazing country in the world. It just, again, it gives an opportunity for perspective and just a different kind of belonging in the world. You know, you're not just American, that there's all kinds of other communities you can belong to, which is useful.
Right. So in your book, somehow you ended up in Australia, living in Byron Bay, I think.
I did.
Running a magazine called Kindred. How did you end up in Australia?
Yes.
And tell us about this magazine, because it sounds fascinating.
Yeah, Kindred is amazing. It's still happening. It's run by a nonprofit. So Santa Fe, New Mexico, I had left the radio station. I really had a job I didn't deserve. I just got it because I was good at interviewing. It completely fried me. And I had a chance encounter with somebody who said to me, if you could be doing anything in the world and making money at it, what would it be? And I think I was 24 at the time. And I said, oh, I'd be living back in Santa Fe. I'd be running a riding school. I'd be training horses. And they said, well, why aren't you doing it? So I just got up and left. I left Dallas and moved back to Santa Fe. Found a sort of shelter horse that needed a home and started to pull together a little riding school. Within 2 years, I had 80 students. I was showing dressage. And it was a really wonderful, you know, I got to own my own business, do what I was loving doing. This whole lifestyle in Santa Fe is amazing, being out in nature and skiing and hiking and backpacking. But there was something about the horse world that really troubled me. And I couldn't put a finger on it because I was still kind of in that trance of conformity. And dressage was so kind of rigid, or at least how I had interpreted dressage was very rigid. And I was seeing two things happen. My clients, my students, whether they were adults or children, if they were spending time with horses, their lives were getting better. They were getting better grades. They were leaving toxic marriages. Just something was happening there that I couldn't put a finger on, but I knew was real. But then there was just all this stress and suffering happening with the riders and the competition and the horses, and the horses were getting injured. And what the heck was this? I mean, we call it love. We say we love our horses, but like, I mean, what would they say about it? Are they happy? Are they fulfilled? Are they feeling good in themselves? I don't think so. And I didn't really want to know the answer, to be honest, because I knew that the answer was going to be, no, they weren't happy and something has to be different. And I didn't know what the solution would be. So I kind of, it created a sort of crisis for me. I would say a spiritual crisis where I was being asked to walk my talk about love and connection and what I knew to be true somewhere that had sort of been buried in me around Kabbata and that experience. But, you know, I had never really spent time with it consciously. And I had to make a living. You know, it was really kind of a crisis point. And as I started to falter around my commitment to the status quo of being a part of that whole conventional horse scene, a couple of my students started to have accidents, like things were starting to, you know, wheels were falling off. So I did what any red-blooded American girl would do, and I went to India.
Really?
Yes. And it wasn't as sudden as it sounds. at this time when this was all starting to kind of fall apart, and in my mind then, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to just quit horses altogether. The horse world is toxic. I can't have anything to do with it. It was all very black and white. And this is often how we think, right, when we're imagining what a change might look like for us. We often think in very black and white ways, and it, of course, is never that way.
Well, I've got to interject here and say that dressage trainer to living in India is quite black and white.
Yes, it was. But I started having dreams about these Indian saints. Very, very strange things started happening to me.
This is before you went to India?
This is before I went to India. I had never meditated, Warwick. I didn't really understand the whole enlightenment thing. I remember I was only 24. And I would wake up and there would be this sense of incense burning in my room, or I'd have dreams of these, like these saints, like Yogananda and Neem Karoli Baba and Sai Baba, and like all these people that I had nothing to do with. It wasn't my scene, but they were coming to me in dreams again and again. I finally had a dream with this very big, bald man. He's sitting in a red velvet chair, and he's Indian, and he says, "You come to India now. You come to Lucknow now." It's a town in India. And yeah, I was so shaken by this. And I guess I was a little wild. I just went, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going. So I packed up my bags. I got a ticket to Delhi. I had no idea where I was going or what I was doing or even why I was there. I just knew I needed answers.
For you guys listening at home, this has shades of Emily Case Dotter going to Jordan. Have you listened to the episode with Emily Case Dotter?
Emily is amazing, and thank you for introducing her to me. I just love that podcast so much, and everyone, please listen to that podcast. Just amazing.
Okay, this is sounding a lot like
you for yes, it was very much. It's very much like that. You know, I think I want to interject here that what you're looking for is also looking for you. You know, you've heard this saying before.
Yeah, it's a Rumi saying, isn't it? What you were seeking,
I think so.
What you were seeking is also seeking you.
Yeah. And it was, I'm telling you, it was. I was scared. I was naive. I didn't know. I was so naive. I put myself in harm's way. I mean, I knew nothing. I knew nothing about traveling to India.
So you went to Delhi. What happened then? You arrive and you...
I went to South India, decided I was going to go and see Sai Baba first. Insane, this guy. So you're in these, like, you're at this ashram. You're in these dorms. You're divided men and women. I was in a room with a family of a mother and three daughters from India. They were from Kerala, I think, and they barely spoke English, but we were in the same dorm room together. Your ability to be around Sai Baba is determined by a lottery system. So you wake up at something like 4 in the morning, get it in these mobs and mobs and mobs of people, lay and sit in line before the sun blazes down at you at like 120 degrees. And it's a lottery. And every day I got like number 2 or number 1. It was just wild. So every day I'm like right there in front of Sai Baba. And the women in my dorm were like, "What is up with you that you can, out of 5,000 people, you every day are in front of this person?" Remember, I had no context for this. So I couldn't have imagined things because I had no context. On the first day, I'm sitting down on the ground in the front row. These gates open up. And I kid you not, Warwick, and I am not a kind of person to exaggerate things. A sea of angels pours over the entire crowd. A sea of angels. I'm thinking, what is this, some fever dream I'm having? What is going on? And out comes this little man, and he says some things to me in, I think, Tamil is the language. I don't know what he's saying. I spend 7 days like this and I think, you know, this isn't for me. I don't know. Maybe I got, you know, the lottery number. Maybe he wants to talk to me, but this is just not for me. So I left and I went north to Lucknow. Lucknow is in the county of Uttar Pradesh. It's a little industrial town, just dirty little town, really. And there was this man, he since has died, named Poonjaji. He must have been about 80 when I first met him. And when I walked into the hall, he's talking about horses. And somebody turns to me and said, he never talks about horses. But the minute you walked in, he's talking about horses. So I think, well, that's okay. That's interesting that we resonate with this. So I spend a few days there. And I, honestly, Warwick, it's embarrassing to tell you. I mean, I really just made such a fool of myself because I didn't know why I was there. And everybody else were these sophisticated spiritual, you know, seekers, and they'd been meditating forever and they'd lived in caves and they knew all the right questions to ask. And I just want to know, like, when am I getting married? And should I, you know, should I keep training horses? You know, I don't know. And he unleashed such ferocity at me. And he did it because he wanted me to ask the right question. So what he did was he humiliated me in front of all these people in the room because I was being stupid. He humiliated me. He teased me. And then when I started to cry, he screamed at me. Well, at that point, I did have an important spiritual question. I mean, I left the hall. I was crying. I was devastated. I was freaked out. I was all alone. I didn't know why this teacher had screamed at me and humiliated me. I wanted to make him wrong. I wanted to leave. And I was staying in a kind of like a bed and breakfast kind of place. And there was a guy there who had been with him for something like 30 years. And he said, you know, there's a reason you're here and it's not what you think it is. And I would just sort of, why don't you hang out another couple of days and just be with what's going on? And so there was a night where I was in so much personal hell of shame and despair and anger and like it was the hell realm of the human experience. And then I was asking the right question, like, how do I get out of this? And that night, I had a very powerful experience of, I don't know how to say it without it sounding contrite, but that none of it was real, that it was all just this passing illusory sensation of experience of, in this case, hell, that wasn't real. And the minute I knew that, I just like, it just kind of popped this bubble. And I would have to say it was this bubble of believing that I'm this person who has these dramas that has to do good, that has to comply. In other words, he put me in such a state of hell that I had to say, or I had to ask the right question. Is this really true? Is this what life is really about? Is this who I really am? And that's a spiritual question. Who am I? That is a spiritual question. You know, am I this piece of skin hanging over these bones? Am I this person with these stories and this narrative? Or am I something deeper than that? And this is what he brought me to. So the next day I went to the meeting and everyone was laughing at me, but I didn't care because I saw what I saw it. I saw what was true. And it was my last day there. And Punjaji, he kind of looks at me across the room and he says, "You come to my private room before you leave." And I go in to his private room and there's two or three other people there who are, it's also their last day. And they were the ones laughing at me. And now they're looking a little bit like, "Oh, wait, something's happened," because I was looking so happy and so carefree. And he says to them, "Oh, don't worry. Don't worry. Because the trick is now in her hand." This is how he was, very enigmatic. And before he had called me tricky, and now he was saying, "The trick is in her hand." And he looks at me and he goes, isn't the trick in your hand now? And I knew what he was saying. He was basically saying, know what's real and know what's not real. That's the trick. And if we think that these passing phenomenon, being lost, being found, being angry, being sad, being happy, being successful, if we think that's what we are and that's what's true, we're in for a heck of a ride. But if we understand that our true nature is this presence underneath it all that watches the success and the failure, that feels the joy and the sadness, that feels found and feels lost, if we stay present to who we are under that, that's the trick. Does that make sense?
Yes. That's a great trick. Wow. You know, it's so interesting. You rock up to India, you go to this ashram where 5,000 people want to have an audience with what's his name, and you're the one who gets the audience every day, and they open the gates and the angels come in, and you're like, no, that's not it. Like, that's not it. I want to go somewhere else. It's like some people probably
just wasn't the right fit, right? It wasn't the right fit. And if I had, but I was lucky because I hadn't enough spiritual ego. If I'd had more spiritual ego, right, I think I would have gotten caught there for a while.
Right. You didn't know what you didn't know, and it worked in your worked in your favor.
It did. It really, really did, yeah.
Okay, so after you learn the trick, what happens then? How do you end up in Byron Bay? I really want to get to this Byron Bay thing because then we get into Australia.
Yes, Byron Bay. So I left India, went back to Santa Fe. Everything blew up at the barn. Horses going lame, people falling off. The horse thing was over for me temporarily. I didn't know that, but it just blew up. I had met somebody in India who was a teacher, and I was now so like laser focused. Now I was going to spend my whole life on this thing, on like meditating and being in the truth. You know, I was like, this is it. So I moved with him to Australia. At that time, what was it, 1988 or something like that? You know, it was 50 cents on the dollar. You could get land for hardly anything. Byron Bay was a sleepy little surf town. And there were a lot of spiritual seekers there. There still are, as you know. And I got pregnant, and I wanted to birth my child in a place where there was the most freedom possible, the most choice around my birth choices. And America was not that place. And Australia was at the time, not so much anymore, but it was very, you know, progressive. You could birth your child at home and still, and not be vilified by the medical system. So pregnancy really is what landed me in Byron Bay, because it was really an ideal place to raise kids. I mean, it was like America in 1940. They would just play out in the streets all day and play on the beach. And, you know, that was really great. So a lot of my focus in Byron Bay was around mothering. My marriage did not last long, and I could write a book about the scenes, behind the scenes of spiritual world, boy oh boy, but I'm not going to, I don't think. And as a single mom, I had to put money on the table, or bread on the table, so how was I going to make money? I had my citizenship. I'm a dual citizen of Australia and America. And I just decided, boy, all these questions about how to raise a good human in this world, how to, you know, be really wisdom informed about what it takes to raise a kind, compassionate, free child. There got to be other people besides me who want to know what, you know, what kind of evidence-based information is out there. So I made Kindred for me because I was a voracious learner and wanted to know about, you know, education practices and food and local farming and the biology of belief and how our neural networks are informed by different habits and all these things that you and I share. This is where Kindred, you know, Kindred really helped me to sort of pull a lot of that in. Attachment theory, systems theory, all of that kind of stuff. Neuroscience, neuroplasticity. Yeah. And my daughter, Mackenzie, when she was 4, she wanted a pony. I had a horse in Australia, and we got her a little Welsh pony. And she said, but Mom, I don't want to do my horses like how you do your horses. I want to do it differently. So this is where I found, this was my first introduction to a different kind of horsemanship. There was a woman there named Louise Kropak who had trained with Ray Hunt. And I just started to see magic unfold when she was working with my daughter and her pony. I was sort of like off to the side, very skeptical at first, right? And I think that's where it sort of came full circle, because the person I had to be to earn my horse's trust, to be in a true concentric relationship with my horse, was a spiritual journey. And so everything kind of came together at that point. My experience with Kabbata, my experiences in India, it was as if horses allowed me a possibility for the embodiment of that understanding, that we are a part of a concentric field and impact one another all the time. And my accountability to that impact and the amount of presence it requires and, I don't know, true perspective of oneness. I mean, really and truly, horsemanship at its finest is that understanding of that oneness.
You know, the thing with it's so interesting that you were watching this lady working with your daughter and her pony, and you still weren't buying into it, but you had all these other interests that should have prepared you to be all in to that. And it's so it's like you had this, you know, you had this world view about everything, but then the horses was, oh no, it's a certain way.
Right.
Yes. And
mm-hmm. I know. Isn't that fascinating? I mean, at some point, of course, I was all in, but I think I have tremendous respect for the way our minds are shaped, right, Warwick? I mean, if you think about, okay, like let's look at this from a horse point of view. If you take an amazing horse and you put him in a cold, dark barn with lots of cruel behavior and lots of toxic food and, you know, his whole environment is just bad from the moment he's awake to the moment he falls asleep, you're going to have a very different horse. And humans are, and I'll just speak for myself, we cannot underestimate the cultural environment and how it constantly informs our brain, our thinking, our biases. And it's constant work to stay awake. This is why it's such good news that what you're looking for is, you know, also looking for you, because honestly, if it were just up to me, I don't know. there was so much of me that was a product of her culture and her family and her society, and it was having a go at me, you know, all day, every day, just as much as the other part that was, you know, more awake. And they were kind of like this a lot, which is why now I'm very careful about what I put in my brain, you know. I don't hang out on social media. I don't hang out with certain people. I don't hang out for certain conversations because I don't want to be infiltrated with things that aren't helpful because they do have an impact. We think they don't, but they do. Our neural networks are so receptive. So it's important the company we keep and the whether that's people or thoughts or habits or energies, is very, very important.
Very much so. Okay, so you know, you're a podcast listener and you know that we've spent quite a bit of time on the podcast talking about, you know, our hunter-gatherer ancestors and indigenous ways of knowing. And in the book, you talk about an Australian Aboriginal named Uncle Bob. And the meeting of him, you met him in Paris, didn't you?
I met him in a way in Paris. So I was pregnant with my third child. In a failing marriage, yet again, another failed marriage. I had been a part of a lot of different spiritual communities and had, just like I'd had been disillusioned with the horse world, I'd become very disillusioned with a lot of the spiritual world and was starting to become lost again in some ways. Was becoming cynical. And anyway, I was in Paris visiting family and doing some work. And I think I was probably in my fourth month of my third pregnancy.
Do you have a copy of your book with you?
I do.
Is there any chance I can get you to read this part?
Sure. Can you tell me what page it's in?
Yes, it would be page 10.
Paragraph starting with.
Can you start right at the top with one of my most influential teachers? And because reading your book, this whole part that you're about to talk about in Paris was very moving to me. And I had thought about, I'd like to read it. I don't think I could get through it.
Thank you. Yeah, we don't talk about these things enough, so I'd be happy to read it. Thank you, Warwick. One of my most influential teachers and close friends, whose wisdom informs the pedagogy of Equus, was an Australian Aboriginal named respectfully Uncle Bob Randall, a Tilpi elder from the Yankunjara and Pintanjara nations in the heart of Australia. He is one of the listed traditional keepers of Uluru, the enormous red rock known to most as Ayers Rock. As an Aboriginal man, Uncle Bob is a member of what is the oldest civilization in the world. He was also a member of the Stolen Generations, the thousands of Aboriginal children kidnapped by missionaries to be raised by the government. The policy, perversely called the Aboriginal Protection Act, sought to totally eradicate the Aboriginal race, As the chief protector of the Aborigines in Western Australia, A.O. Neville wrote in an article for the West Australian in 1930, "Eliminate the full blood and permit the white admixture to half-castes, and eventually the race will become white." I first encountered Uncle Bob in 2008 while in Paris, of all places. I was traveling with my then husband and two young children and was several months pregnant with my third child. I was living in Byron Bay, Australia as the founding editor of Kindred when a publisher asked me to compile an anthology of stories about belonging after reading an editorial I had written on the topic. So at the time, I was collecting various essays from writers all around the world, some of them from Indigenous writers. My once resilient marriage was now fragile, and I hoped that our new baby might strengthen our ties. But the trip only provided more stress, and we argued a lot. One afternoon, as I climbed up a flight of narrow, creaking stairs to our simple hotel with my husband and children in tow, I began to miscarry. By the time I made it to our room, I had lost her. What does one do with a dead child in a hotel room in Paris? In our shock, everything became oddly strange and remotely practical. We found an empty pastry box from our breakfast, carefully swaddled her in a napkin, and placed her inside. Like zombies, we walked with the little box to the only place that we felt right, Notre Dame. We lit candles and held each other. As we emerged from the great cathedral, again we were faced with the question of what to do with her next. Our eyes sadly landed on the Seine River. Without saying a word, my son looked up at me, went back inside the cathedral, and came out with a handful of small candles. We carried the box to the river's edge. On its lid, we placed the candles and some small flowers we gathered from bushes. We lit the candles, then we released the box into the current. I watched the Seine carry my last child out to sea. A part of me went down the river with her into the abyss. That afternoon, we huddled around a cafe table trying to pull ourselves together, feeling way too far away from home. I dully looked up over my tea at a bulletin board hanging over the counter. To my surprise, there was a small poster promoting a community screening of an Australian film called Kanyini, featuring Uncle Bob. As I looked upon Uncle Bob's face, a sudden thought pierced through my traumatized haze. I needed him in the belonging book. I made a mental note to myself to find him when I returned to Australia. Shall I stop there or continue?
Let's stop there.
What does that touch in you, Warwick?
That's the thing, I don't know. It touches me somewhere, but I'm not sure where, and I'm not sure what it is. But thank you for reading that, because like I said, I wanted people to hear that, but I was pretty sure I couldn't do it. So thank you.
Yeah.
And probably the next bit, we probably could have read a little bit further, but when you finally called Uncle Bob, he answered the phone and he said, "I've been waiting for you."
He did. Yeah. "I've been waiting for you." And I sort of briefly said, "I'm doing this book. I'd love to interview you." He goes, "I'll meet you in Sydney next week." And he hung up the phone. So, you know, again, I mean, there was just all these times in my life where I'm like, and I had never met an Aboriginal man. I mean, you know, Warwick, so many of those folks are kept tucked away, kind of neatly tucked away, and peas don't touch the carrots in Australia. And I had not been exposed to an Aboriginal person. So I got my ticket and knew I was going to meet him in Sydney at the airport sometime on that Saturday. So I just flew in Saturday morning and hung around. And he showed up. And I didn't know Uncle Bob. I mean, I had a Airbnb for us, you know, a microphone, and 3 days to live with him and record his words. That could have gone very badly, or it could have, I mean, who knows? I didn't know. I credit Uncle Bob for you know, I say the horses kind of pulled everything together, and Uncle Bob is very much a part of that, because there's so much spiritual ego out there in the spiritual, so-called spiritual world, and Uncle Bob's spirituality is, to call it spirituality is just, it way downplays it. He is, Uncle Bob is what Kabbalah is, which is the truth of this existence. And Uncle Bob sort of returned me back to just this real understanding of what Kabbalah had awakened in me. But now I'm an adult, and now I understand. And now I can, with everything I've been through, I can now claim it as my experience also. You know, I'm no longer a 7-year-old girl. And I'm so grateful, because he really just pointed my internal compass really right where it needed to be. And he didn't know that I loved horses and that I worked with horses. And we had many, many different times of working together. And one time I went out to Uluru and he picked me up without saying a word. He didn't say a word to me. He handed me a bottle of water and we just start driving, and he's not talking to me. And I'm thinking, oh my God, he's mad at me, or oh my God, I'm being kidnapped, or oh God. And for, you know, 1 hour passes, 2 hours pass, 3 hours, he's not talking to me. I am freaking out. Everything I try to do to get some kind of conversation, he's just not having it. After about 6 hours of driving out to the middle of nowhere, I finally kind of just, something in me just gives up. And he turns to me and he goes, "It's better, isn't it?" He just was not about standing on ceremony, right? So where he's taking me to, where is he taking me? He says, "I have a surprise for you. It's a 7-hour surprise out to the bush, wild horses." And we walk out to this billabong, and we sit by the billabong, and he says, "They'll come around sometime." And we sit for hours. Suddenly, all these wild Brumbies come over the hill, and he says to me, "As long as you stay connected to them, you will never get lost." So I pass that to you, because we're with the right group, you know. We're with the right allies, our horse allies.
Yeah, I think so. So I'd love to know more about Uncle Bob, if you've got stories to share about him.
Yeah, sure. So Uncle Bob did not, you know, there are many, many Indigenous people in Australia feel like the white folks should not be privy to any of the teachings or traditions of their kind, which I understand and appreciate. Uncle Bob felt differently. He felt that his folks were too traumatized to take on the traditions and the teachings and the stories, and that he, and there are many different elders from Lakota Nation and Hopi Nation and Navajo Nation who believe the same way as well, that they need to find those who have an Aboriginal heart to pass on the stories. And so I realized I might be kind of walking a line of cultural appropriation in recording all of his teachings, but he requested this. And so I have hours and hours and hours of his his words that I've transcribed. Only some of it is in this book and some of it is in another book. Uncle Bob was stolen as a young child by a police officer on a camel. He was shipped by train to one of the missionaries and also forgot who he was. You know, you and I talk about this forgetting, this getting lost. There was a period of time where Uncle Bob forgot all of his, who he was and where he came from and what his teachings were and just sort of became indoctrinated into the white ways. And as a young adult, and I don't know about how old, maybe in his 30s, he traced back his roots. He went back to his homeland near Uluru and started to wake back up to who he was and the legacy that he carried. Like Kabata, his heart was so open and he loved with all of himself. He cried easily. He felt things right there. He was vulnerable, fierce. And, you know, we were sitting together once. And this is told in the book, but we were sitting together at the Sydney airport together after one of our times together while I was transcribing his work. And it was about 5 a.m. and he and I were at a cafe and we're drinking coffee together. And he's telling, anytime you sat down with Uncle Bob, he'd be telling stories, teaching. It wouldn't stop. And he's telling me about the death ritual when somebody dies, painting their faces white, not saying someone's name after they've died because they've merged already with something that's so sacred that you're not to name their name anymore. And as he's telling this story, he's crying and the world is starting to kind of swirl around us at the airport, you know, sort of waking up people with briefcases and on Bluetooth and cell phones and all being very serious and ties and rush. And I'm just suddenly realizing this juxtaposition. I've got this man from the 60,000-year-old culture sitting with me crying about his people's lost tradition. And then this like crazy world swirling around us. And it suddenly dawned on me what we had lost. You and I, Warwick, as, you know, privileged white people. And I started to cry, and Uncle Bob said, "Oh, are you crying for my people?" And I said, "No, Uncle Bob." And he was sort of like, "What do you mean you're not crying for my people?" I said, "I'm crying for mine." And he was sort of like, "What? I don't understand." And I said, "Uncle Bob, your people have lost everything, but they know they've lost everything. We have lost everything, and we don't even know that we've lost it. We're so lost, we don't know we're lost." And, you know, this is where it's not that we want to throw back to 60,000 years ago, but we don't have to throw away these beautiful knowings of our relationship to all of life. We don't have to throw away our identity as white people or Australians or Americans to take on a certain kind of sanity that basically acknowledges that we are love, that we live in a concentric field of aliveness with plants and animals and organisms and rocks and trees and soil, and that we belong in that. And to be in that is a very, very joyful experience, even when things are hard and terrible and difficult. So this was really the gift of Uncle Bob, and it continues. Uncle Bob passed about 5 years ago, but he's everywhere. We had a little message that whenever a little Willy Wagtail, you know those birds?
Mm-hmm.
whenever one would land on my window, that was my signal to call Uncle Bob. And I would give him a call and he'd say, oh, the Willy Wagtail must, you know, I've been thinking about you. And we don't have those birds here in America, but there is a bird that does something similar. Every time I see that bird, I know Uncle Bob is connecting with me. And, you know, this isn't magical thinking. This is just physics. You know, we don't disappear. We just change form. And there's such a beautiful intelligence to the world. And all we have to do is participate in it. That's it.
Yeah, there's a... Have you ever heard of a book called Real Magic by a guy named Dean Radin?
No.
He's the head of the Institute for Noetic Sciences in north of San Francisco there. But his book's called Real Magic, and it's about magic, probably magic with a K, not magic with a C kind of thing. And like he was a dyed-in-the-wool scientist of some type, you know, like if you can't scientifically prove it, it's not right. There sort of thing. And he had, I guess he, maybe, I don't know, I'll have to get him in the podcast one day, I'd love to. Maybe he had some sort of a spiritual awakening. But anyway, yeah, so he's at that Institute of Noetic Sciences, they do a lot of trying to prove, you know, like kinesiology and remote viewing. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, like, did you hear of, what was it called? Project MK Ultra, I think. So it was back during the Cold War. The US had the US government had a thing called MK Ultra, and they were trying to use remote viewing and kinesiology and stuff like that to fight with the Cold War. And what's so interesting is they were using that, but you never saw the front page of the New York Times or whatever say, by the way, kids, this is a thing. It's real. You know what I mean?
It's
like we'll use it, but we won't promote it. We won't let you know about it because then we don't have control of it, you know?
Yeah. You know, colonization, when you look at it not from just kind of geopolitical lines and, you know, the ways that different how racism has emerged from as a construct from colonization, but when you really look at it as a systemic erasing of our collective memory of these things, such as our connection, knowing that we're consciousness, you know, all of this was ripped from all of us when we, as a result of colonization. And colonized thinking keeps perpetuating the myth that we're separate, that the invisibles don't exist, you know, that there are no other realms. And it's just a construct that kind of wants to rob us of these deeper understandings.
At the our podcast summit in San Antonio this year, I was talking to one of my podcast guests who is in the same kind of line of work as you, kind of transformational coach sort of thing, Julie Ripley. And we were talking about what is the podcast really about? And then we came up with the line, it is the podcast is about this is not exactly how we put it, but it was basically changing the bullshit story we've been told. unraveling, I think was the line. Unraveling the bullshit story we've all been told.
Yes, I love it. And we have to continually work that because it just keeps, you know, trying to seep back in. And that is our work, to keep unraveling that bullshit story. And it's a sad story.
Very sad. You know what? We might get to some of your questions here because I'm pretty sure they'll take us some places. Well, your biggest failure, let's go with that. That was the one you chose first. What's been your biggest failure and how has it helped you?
My biggest failure is my failed marriages, and I've had a few. it's something I used to have a lot of shame about, and I no longer do. But I saw that they were failures, and now I see that they've just been a part of, you know, the tapestry and fabric of my life and my learning. I would say that those, one person was an opiate addict, didn't start out that way, but was, you know, part of the collateral damage of the opioid epidemic in America, with so many white collar people who just ended up on the wrong side of a prescription slip, right? And walking through that was wow. And I have learned so much about the power of our past, how we're hardwired as children, how things can kind of go along until you're about 32 and then wham, some historic trauma sort of shows up and takes a hold of you, and people change. And so I think ultimately that failure has granted me enormous compassion, not just for myself, but for just people. Boy, it's really tough being human. And there's so much that we have to walk through. And pain either breaks you or breaks you open. And with luck, you know, I will continue to choose to allow it to break me open rather than to break me. But I would just say the human condition and the opportunity to walk with my heart way more open than before.
You know, it was interesting you mentioned you had just been talking about, I guess, colonialization. Was that what you were talking about before?
Colonization,
uh-huh. Yeah, you know, talking about that, and a lot of times conversations like that go hand in hand with capitalism. And you know, I've watched some documentaries on the opioid crisis and the fact that the companies knew they
yes.
were addictive,
yes.
but told all the falsified scientific
yes.
tests and told all the doctors, no, this is safe to prescribe. You're good. Like, and they were prescribing Oxy for like headaches and stuff.
Oh, yes.
You know, so you could end up being an opiate addict because you went to the doctor because you had headaches.
That's exactly what happened to my ex-husband. Yeah, he had headaches. So
it's just it's mind-boggling.
It's just it's mind-blowing and so difficult. And when I tried to, you know, rally friends, no one really knew what the opioid epidemic was then. They were everybody was still kind of in it, right? And it was just so bad. You know, I was scapegoated because I was trying to raise the alarm bell and they said I was just blaming, and it's not blame at all. It's just saying that this is a thing. Mm. And what I learned about the opiate pill is that the molecule, they call it the God molecule, but the brain mistakes it for its connection to God. And we're wired to connect to something greater than ourselves. We're hardwired to connect to something greater. And when that drug enters into your bloodstream, your brain mistakes that for God and becomes not only addicted, but fanatically. This is why people can't get off, because it's you're basically asking this person to give up God. But it's not conscious that way. It's a biology thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very, yeah. The whole big pharma thing is fascinating. You know, my wife and I, we are now watching like different series on TV on like Hulu mm-hmm. and things like that. And they have ads. Whereas, you know, for a long time, we just watch mm-hmm. Netflix, and Netflix doesn't have ads. And the ads that are on there for pharmaceuticals, and then the list of side effects.
Yeah.
That most of them are much worse than the actual condition that the person's living with. And it's just, it's pretty
well, amazing. part of colonization is this trance that does not teach us how to deal with pain, emotional pain, physical pain, and pathologizes pain. And so then we want to, not have pain. And the pills promise no pain in a certain, some version of no pain. That's not to say that some folks don't need certain things, but it's gone completely over the top. And people aren't taught, especially when they're children, how to deal with difficult sensations like boredom, right? And loss and frustration and anger. These are normal parts of being a human.
Mm.
And this is how you be with them.
Right. We don't really have an education on how to do that.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, it's amazing. Okay, next question. What have you changed in the past 5 years that has helped shape who you've become?
I used to have a belief that life is hard. Life was meant to be hard. And when I finally discovered it, it was so odd. I'm like, what a funny belief to have around. But, and how come I never saw it before? But around 5 years ago, I saw it. I saw that narrative and saw it for what it was. And no, I mean, yeah, there's times when things are difficult, but, life is not meant to be hard. And just in the confronting of that one little narrative, kind of changed everything. It took away the striving for, getting more done or feeling like, I had to really work hard in this particular relationship or on that certain project to make it happen. And I just hold things a lot more lightly now, and I'm happier.
It's really interesting. So the next question that you chose was, and we're not going to get to that question yet, but I'm going to tell you about the question. It's, what do you feel your true purpose is? And recently I was watching something and it was talking about how your purpose, your mission, the reason you're here, your gift, whatever. And it was basically described as the thing you do. Oh, sorry, I better back up. I'm going to preface this with, I have this story I tell myself, because I've always avoided the hard things in life, okay? Painful things, whatever. And I have this story I keep telling myself that's the problem, because I've avoided stuff, blah, 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 this shame or whatever. And this guy was saying, your purpose here in life is your gift, your mission is whatever you do that helps the world at large and is the easiest thing for you to do. Like the thing that takes you no effort. And I'm always beating myself up because I've always chosen the things that take the least amount of effort and got this story about how it shouldn't have been that way and I must be weak because, all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm,
and then this
right.
thing this thing kind of hit me between the eyes, like, that is your, whatever it is that takes the least amount of effort is the thing you're supposed to be doing. You know what I mean? And it was, I think it might have even been Steve Harvey. I can't remember who it was, but it was.
Sounds very Steve Harvey, yeah.
Yeah, and it was, how he talks. He's.
Yeah.
Quite emotive, but and it really struck me, like, oh, I've never really heard it put that way. But he was saying the thing, and it might have been on like TikTok or something where you can't save it, but I think I shared it to someone so that I could find it in the messengers later,
right.
But it was just really like the thing that you do the easiest, that takes you no effort at all, that's what you're supposed to be doing. So, yeah, anyway, let's get to this next question then. So what do you feel your true purpose is?
I see in people that which is already luminous and awake. I mean, you talk about what's easy, right? It just happens. I see it. And so my job is to serve that, whether it's to help it come to the fore or validate it for someone or point it out because it's too close for them to see, or to help it kind of actualize more in the world. But I see people and animals and things. So, yeah, and it comes very easily.
Yeah, that is, I don't think I've ever heard that answer, either on my podcast or anywhere else I've heard that question asked. That's, can you elaborate more on that? I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah. Well, thank you, because I've never had the opportunity to elaborate. So thank you. So I'll just be processing externally, if I may. You know, it's like if I were to have a visual, I would see whether it's an animal or a person or a situation, it has all these layers around it. And I guess you could call these layers personality or habits or beliefs or structures. But somewhere kind of in there, there's something that is whole and luminous and free. And it used to get me into a lot of trouble when I was younger, because I would meet people and I would see that thing and I would attach to that and not pay attention to the rest, you know? And so I could get involved with some sketchy people that, you know, who weren't living by that. But,
can I interrupt there?
Yeah,
so
you
got involved with some sketchy people. Is that because you only saw the good in them?
That's a way of saying it. Yeah.
You're looking at all the good, but you were not paying attention to the sketchy parts.
I wasn't paying attention to the sketchy parts.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was a lesson I had to learn, where I could get that discernment. I've learned, you know, over the years to also see the other, right? Because that's also important. I also have learned that if someone doesn't want to have that other part revealed, that it's actually an act of violence to try and reveal it for them. That could be a whole podcast work, but it's a thing.
Violence.
They're not ready. They don't want it, and they will resent you for it.
I've been listening to an audio book about nonviolent communication. Have you ever heard of nonviolent communication? Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. Yeah. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Like, it is, yeah.
Oh, I have to, like, retool the way I interact with the world. You know, like retool my vocabulary and the way I say things if I want to. It's almost like, it's funny listening to that book, it's almost like, oh yeah, that's what I do non-verbally with horses. I've just got to be able to do it verbally with people.
Yes.
And it's not my, that's, you know, I don't have an education in that type of language. Like, I'm on my second listening of the book and I'm still like, you know what I mean?
It wasn't hardwired into our linguistic education.
No, but imagine if it had been.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Every word
has a reality, right? So how we articulate things also shapes our brain. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. Okay. Your next question is, do you have any regrets that you would wish to share with us, and what did you learn from them?
I do have regrets. I used to be like, oh, I have no regrets, but of course I have regrets. I think my biggest regret is around animals. When I was younger and I just didn't quite get the soul of an animal. And I think there was a part of my egoic structure that just didn't want to, because frankly, I was too selfish. I was young and selfish. And, you know, with all the kind of leaving the country and going here and there and going to India, there were animals I left behind. And I regret that. I regret not ensuring their well-being. You know, they were kind of taken care of, but not in a way I would have handled things now. And they didn't have a say in the matter. So a lot about what I do now here, I have a small ranch with 8 equines, 3 dogs, 2 cats, 2 donkeys. This is their forever home. I've set up a trust so that if something happens to me, they're taken care of. Because it's really no small thing to be a custodian of land and an animal. It's serious, serious business. And so that how I was when I was young and immature and careless and selfish is very much informed, you know, who I try to be now.
Yeah, I'm sitting here nodding while you're saying that, but I'm sure every person listening that's ever had an animal in the past is probably sitting here nodding along with you and along with me. And, you know, I think that's just one of those you've got to forgive yourself for what you didn't know before you knew it sort of thing.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Yeah. And your last question that you chose was about leaders and followers. What does it mean? What does leadership and followership mean to you? And what does it mean to be a good, what do you need to be a good leader and a good follower?
I learned about leadership from my alpha mare, Artemis, who I've just watched for years, how she leads from behind, always pushing the younger ones or more insecure ones out to the fore, and so that they can be more brave, be more intelligent, make better choices. And it's not about her. The leadership is really about the one she's leading. And in fact, if you didn't know that she was the lead horse, you wouldn't think she was, because she's so understated, because it's just not about her. Mm-hmm. So leadership to me, the mark of leadership isn't by, oh, look at that person, but by the fruit that they bear, the people that are empowered because of them. If you're seeing them, there's a good leader behind them that you're not seeing. So in a way, leadership is a little bit about invisibility. To be a good follower, you have to be brave, and you have to be out there in the front and willing to take on your own leadership in the following position. So you're not just throwing your power away. You're cultivating your leadership in the act of following. You're not relegating your responsibility in the act of following.
So you were just talking about your horses and dogs and cats and donkeys in New Mexico. So let's talk about actually what you do as one of the things I guess you are as a transformational coach. Do you conduct things at your facility in New Mexico?
Mm-hmm. Yes. A lot of people engage with me virtually, which is so terrific. I love that. I love that that's happening in the world now. But for people who have the resources and the desire, they can come to Santa Fe. And oftentimes people will work with me one-on-one for a day or two. And I immerse them in time in the land, time with the horses, time with some of the indigenous partners that I work with, so that I can undo some of that, as you say, bullshit that we've been taught, yeah, and awaken something that feels much more authentic to people. And or they may just come for a couple of hours with the horses. The horses are amazing, as you know. They just show up in these super magical ways. And, you know, my job is to just really listen to what it is that they're communicating and sharing with folks. So it's always nice when the horses are involved, for sure. But it's definitely only, you know, not a huge, it's not the lion's share of the work I do, because not everyone can come out here and do that.
Right. You mentioned the land. I've not been to Santa Fe, but I've been to I've been to Sedona, and so I kind of have an idea of. Actually, you know, I've been to Kakadu in Australia too, and it has a, and this is before I even thought land had energy. But when I went to Kakadu, I felt like that land had an energy to it. I bet Santa Fe really has that, does it?
It does. It does. And it's, you know, we're at 7,500 feet. So right now there's snow everywhere. And so it's a little hybrid between Arizona and Colorado. So we have mountains and rivers and snow, but not quite as lush as Colorado. But it does have an energy. And the land really, you know, it speaks to people. And if I can assist people to quiet down enough and validate some of the ways that land does speak to people, then they start to feel it too and have their own connection, which is really important. It helps people to, you know, human beings have been accessing nature's wisdom for, you know, millennia, and it's only just recently that people just decided the only, you know, go-to folks are other humans. But that's a little bit like kindergartners teaching each other how to drive. I mean, humans have only been around for, what, 6 million years, depending on where you throw the needle. And nature's 3.8 billion years of evolutionary intelligence. So there's so much there to be an ally to folks, to help them. I mean, I'll have a CEO come out here and work with something as practical as their next strategic plan. And then they'll go and spend 4 hours solo in the wilderness and come back with some majorly innovative information.
Wow.
You know,
one of your qualifications on your CV here is you are a motivational speaker. Do you have a typical group of people that you would talk to and something like that?
It's super diverse. Just this last year, I ended up speaking to a lot of university students, which was surprising to me. And boy, they were so thirsty for the kind of things that you and I are talking about. I confess, I didn't think that there would be that kind of interest in someone in that age group, but I was really, really wrong. And you know, you have an adult son, like everyone who's like anywhere between 20 and 30, they're so amazing right now. They're such amazing people.
Yes. Right? It's like my son's 26 now, but like when he was he was still very wise when he was 22. And I was thinking, when I was 22, I was a dickhead.
I know, me too. I was a dickhead too. And they're just so wise, and they're just thinking about like so many things. So that's been amazing. Corporate groups, people tend to come to me when they've sort of surfed to the end of their own internet, and they're like, wait, there's no there. What's going on? I need to find my new there.
And the motivational speaking, do you, like, you travel to places for that? Do you travel much?
I travel a little bit, but not a ton, because, as you know, it's tricky to find ranch sitters. So I'm maybe gone once a month, and a lot of my speaking happens virtually. Right. I had a couple of gigs, you know, in person. Shell Oil, you know, work is always amazing. Who ends up getting me to come and speak with them? I recently did a talk with a bunch of executives from Texas and at Shell Oil, and people are listening.
That's good. You know, Another of my podcast guests, Beth Ann Standig, who used to live near us. She's since moved to Maine, but she used to live near us, and she does equine-assisted therapy and equine-assisted learning, and she used to do a lot of corporate stuff. And my wife, Robin, was helping her a little bit, and one of the days they had a bunch of lawyers, for Shell lawyers, come down there. And my wife came home and was telling me about how spot on the horses were about things with this group of people who don't really know anything about horses. And yeah, it was fascinating. I forget what the story was. I forget half the stories or most of the stories, but it was the gist of the story was the horse would do something. The person's like, oh God, they saw me. That's
right. Yeah, totally. That's the thing.
That's the thing, yeah. So tell us about, so you're the founder of the Equus Experience. Can you tell us a bit about that?
So the Equus Experience is my trademarked version of equine-assisted learning. And it just weaves in all the elements that we talked about in this podcast. It weaves in indigenous wisdom. It weaves in neuroplasticity, systems theory, biomimicry, all kinds of things, spirituality, presence-based awareness. The horses kind of provide so much material, and then whatever they bring forward, we're able to work with. And then the horses provide feedback about how that has shifted for someone. Mm. So like very, very superficially, or just very sort of simply and practically, someone may come in who it's revealed that they have very porous boundaries. And of course the horses, I mean, they really see that right away. And we'll find out a bunch of things around that topic through the work with the horses. And then we'll go and work on it through somatic experiencing, through different kinds of experiences. And then we'll go back out to the horses. And the horses always are like, whoa, what just happened to you? those lovely ears that are like, now I respect you.
Right, now I get it. Now you're in your power.
Wow. Now you're in your power.
Yeah, that's very cool. Well, Kelly, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. We could do this for like hours and hours and on end. But
thank you so much.
Yeah, I just appreciate what you're doing out there in the world. You're making the world a better place.
Thank you, as are you. It was really an honor. I really mean it, work, just to have the way you hold space and allow for things to come forward. And I'm a better, more informed, more aware person as a result of our conversation. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And how do people find you?
Equusinspired.com. Equus is the Latin, E-Q-U-U-S, inspired.com, or kellywendorf.com. Either of those will find me.
I know you said you stay away from social media. Do you put stuff in any social
media? My team's all over it. So we're on LinkedIn and Facebook and all those places, and Instagram.
Is it Kelly Wendorf, or is it?
It'll all be Equus Inspired.
Okay, Equus Inspired. Okay.
Yes.
And your book, Flying Lead Change, where can people get that?
Yes, they can get it on Amazon. Or if you're a podcast listener of Warwick's and you want to email me and get it 50% off, I'm happy to do that too. Oh, so you can just reach out to me and just get a special little discount for being part of Warwick's community.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much.
This book,
Flying Lead Change, 56 Million Years of Wisdom for Leading and Living. Such a good book. Such a good book. The information that's in it, how it's presented, and the stories. Like, I'm a storyteller, and I appreciate learning through story. And yeah, there's a lot of stories in there. Just an amazing book. And like I said, I haven't got all the way through it yet, but I'm looking forward to slowly chewing on it and devouring it.
It's a slow read. It's meant to be. It's meant to be lingered over. So,
yes, it's definitely a lingering book. And I'm thinking I'm going to have to be lingering over this podcast again.
Thank you, Warwick.
You're welcome. And you guys at home, thanks for joining us. And we'll catch you next time on another episode of the Journey On podcast. So if you love this episode of the podcast with Kelly, there's actually an opportunity to see her live and interact with her in person at our Journey On podcast summit. Our next year's summit will be held in Paso Robles on the 24th, 25th, 26th and 27th of October. And this is the first time announcing it, and there's going to be a lot of details coming out soon. There'll be emails and social media posts and other episodes of the podcast will give you all the details. But for now, we're just announcing the US dates, which, like I said, are in October, the 24th to the 27th, and Kelly has agreed to be there. We also are having a UK summit next year, so on the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th of August in Birmingham. And like I said, there'll be more details coming out about that soon, but one of the people who have agreed, one of the podcast guests who've agreed to present there is Emily Kay's daughter, and we just had a thing come out that our highest downloaded episode of 2023 was Emily Kay's daughters, and everybody I've spoken to that's listened to that podcast just can't get enough of it. So you get a chance to see Emily live in the UK, and of course there's way more than Emily and Kelly coming. There's so many amazing people, but anyway, I just wanted to give you guys a bit of a heads up about that, so you can kind of at least save the dates, and we'll be sending out emails and social media posts about the both those summits pretty soon.
Thanks for being a part of the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 850 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.